Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, we're going to be talking with the chair of the UNC School of Medicine's Department of Anesthesiology, Dr. David Zavara, about a patient guide to anesthesia and surgery, something really critical for anyone who has to undergo surgery.
But first, we have some research that matters, some good, some not so good, and some sort of funny.
This is the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Yeah, exactly.
And the funny.
And the funny.
Well, here's a good one here, Christy. This first article that was about, 46 million Americans that are trying to quit smoking, and this is some research that may help them.
And we know that telephone counseling can be beneficial to helping people quit smoking, and that some internet programs can be helpful. But this was a study looking at a web-based program versus having the internet program plus some personal phone calls versus just some internet page that had some general info to see what was most helpful in helping people quit smoking.
Yeah, you know, this article in the Archives of Internal Medicine, after 1.5 years, 15% of those who use this program, which is actually a proprietary program that people have to spend $100 a year to have, so that is a little bit of an issue, but 15% of them who use that plus the phone program did not smoke at the end of that time, compared to much smaller, half of home only got the one versus the other alone.
Yeah, and I mean, that's pretty significant to me. And to me, if granted, the $100 could be a barrier, but whatever it takes to help you quit smoking is what, you know, is important to do. And so I was encouraged I think that personal connection, the phone call reminder, and they set it up during that first month where they made more frequent phone calls, which is the time that most people start smoking again. So yeah. It makes sense that that would be more effective.
Yeah, we know social support is so critical, and the support both from people in your family as well as the professional support, and this offers that professional support. The simple fact is, though, unfortunately, that 85% of this population is still smoking at the end of the year. So we got a lot more to do, but this is promising. Try to get a program that gives you the best chance of success, the most social support.
Do you want to put your plug in for the Nicotine Independence Clinic?
We do have a great NDP, or Nicotine Dependence Program, at the University of North Carolina that I direct. And anyone who's a smoker out there, we can help you with support and with a comprehensive approach. So, yes, Christy, thank you so much. They can go to ndp.unc.edu. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. The next study is about reducing heart risk by getting an air filter.
Wait, say that again. I want to see if I heard that right.
Yeah, they're talking about trying to decrease your risk for heart disease by breathing pure air through these high-efficiency particle air filters.
Well, and this was an article that was in the American Journal of Respiratory and Critical Care Medicine, and it came out of British Columbia because apparently wood-burning stoves are the main source of pollution there, and there was some belief that these filters could help cut down on the pollution, which might improve blood cardiovascular health.
And basically, they did find that the filters work to help decrease the average concentration of fine particles, to improve their measures for endothelial function, which is a part of your blood vessels, and to decrease inflammation. And those things are predictors of heart problems. But I felt like reading this was like, okay, but I'd love to see more research to see that, you know, it actually makes a difference for patients' lives.
Yeah, you know, certainly this piques my interest about the relationship between things that are easy to do, though. There's no downside other than the cost of getting a really good filter. And if it does cut down on what you breathe in terms of pollution, that probably is a good thing in and of itself. So we don't know if this long-term has an impact, but probably not a risky thing to try.
Sure, and especially if it's not expensive. The next one, though, is remarkable to me. This is about having private rooms in the intensive care unit versus sharing a room with someone else being effective to lower infection risks.
Yeah, this is one of the more important pieces of research, I think, but tantalizing. I don't know if it's definitive, but tantalizing that Christy and I will probably talk about in a good while. And it's in the Archives of Internal Medicine. And we know that when we go into the hospital, that the risk of actually getting an infection is a real risk. And there's lots of things that have been done to try to lower that risk, including really having your doctors and your nurses and the healthcare people wash their hands really frequently.
Yeah, hand washing is critical. But this was a study looking at about 20,000 ICU admissions.
Intensive care unit admissions, those really sick patients.
Between the years of 2000 and 2005 at two different hospital centers, one of those centers had undergone an overnight switch to have only private intensive care unit rooms in March of 2002. And the other one continued to have the rooms that are shared between at least two patients.
Yeah, and, you know, these hospitals recorded thousands of cases of infections with bacteria and funguses over these many years, including these ones with this MRSA, that resistant bacteria, and even more resistant bacteria. And this transition really reduced the rate when you were in these private rooms of infections compared to the semi-private rooms.
Yeah, the risk of a patient acquiring an infection fell by 54%.
That's huge.
That is huge after the transition to the private rooms. And then the average patient in a private room stayed in that intensive care unit 10% fewer days after that. And because one of the reasons that patients often stay there longer is because they get an infection. So it makes sense that they didn't require that high level of care for quite as long.
Yeah, and this raises all kinds of questions that we won't get into today, and this research doesn't address, but it really raises the question that, for instance, would private rooms around the entire hospital really lower infection? And if so, well, could the hospital afford that?
Yeah.
Would you, the sizes, could you, the expense and the reimbursement? You know, I remember, Christy, when I did rotations in other hospitals in other countries, frequently you have 10, 20 patients in a common room. It's not this even semi-private room. So it makes me think, oh my goodness, maybe that model isn't the right model.
Well, and you also wonder, is it the germs being transmitted throughout the room from coughing or whatever, or is it that doctors and nurses aren't as likely to wash their hands if they're going from a patient in one room just to across the room? I don't know.
But certainly, if you have a loved one and you want to advocate for a private room and the insurance can get it paid for, it's probably a good thing.
Okay, so our last research is about clowns. And I really mean what I say, clowns. We're talking about red nose and, you know, colorful hair, like ha-ha clowns.
Yep, and we're going to talk about research that looks at clowning and getting pregnant. We're not joking here. This is what the research is, and it's kind of funny.
It is kind of funny. So this was a study of 219 women who are undergoing in vitro fertilization in Israel.
And it's in the journal Fertility and Sterility.
Mm-hmm. And they were looking to see if patients who were entertained by a professional medical clown right after they had embryos implanted in their womb were more likely to have that result in a pregnancy.
Yep. And those that of the 36% that got pregnant with these clowns compared to 20% who did not get pregnant, who weren't exposed to these kinds of clowns. and you know, that's statistically significant difference there, that the clowns led to higher pregnancy.
Yeah, I mean, and the theory is that maybe being happy or laughing might be an important part of sort of reducing stress and allowing your body to become pregnant. All it took was a 15-minute visit from the clown, and that's pretty, I mean, you can't. It's unlikely to hurt someone with that.
Yeah, well, so the researchers said it was the least hazardous intervention in our field. And frequently, I think it's one of the more funny ones as well. I mean, you know, though I would have worried that, you know, laughing so hard, you might have, you know, that might have done something, you know, like sometimes when I laugh so hard, my stomach hurts. And,
yeah,
you know.
Well, I laughed when it said that this university in Israel is launching a degree program in medical clowning. For some reason, I read that and just giggled.
Well, I think I'm going to volunteer to do some collaboration collaborative sabbatical work over there with our colleagues in Haifa, you know, and bring this back to the show. But it's important work. It's serious work, even though it's funny to read and talk about, because it really, this is an issue. And if it really increases it, boy, what a fun, funny, and effective intervention.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
well, Christy,
so
this probably concludes our Research That Matters.
It sure
talking
does.
About medical clowning and fertility.
Talked about lowering infection, possibly from private ICU rooms.
HEPA filters may or may not reduce your heart risk, but, you know, it might cut down pollution.
And about phone chats plus web programming to help you quit smoking.
We'll take a short break right now. When we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Zavara about a patient guide to anesthesia and surgery. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking with Dr. David Zavara about a patient guide to anesthesia and surgery.
And, you know, Christy, I really was thinking about this a lot. A lot of my family has had surgery recently, and just being exposed to anesthesia in a different light, not as a provider, but as a family member. And so I was really thrilled when I ran into Dr. Zavara, and he agreed to be our guest today. Dr. David Zavara is the chair of anesthesiology at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine. He serves on the American Board of Anesthesiology, as well as the board of directors for the Society of Cardiovascular Anesthesiology. He's nationally recognized as a researcher and educator and the author of textbooks. Welcome to the show, Dr. Zavara.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
Dr. Zavara, thanks for being with us. And tell us, did you always know you wanted to put people to sleep?
Well, I'm really good at putting people to sleep, and it was a talent of mine, but I didn't realize that I could do it professionally. And
hopefully wake them up, too.
Yeah, well, then wake them up. Yeah, well, that's the trick. No, and most folks don't that go into anesthesia. We're sort of a quiet profession. We float along behind the scenes, and many of our medical students that end up going into anesthesiology don't really learn about the field until their third or fourth year of medical school, and that was my case.
What piqued your interest? What was there an experience? Was there a patient encounter? What happened?
Well, my experience is very common, and that is growing up, I had role models in surgery, and so I thought I was going to go to medical school and become a surgeon, and that was my life plan. I was ready to do it, and then in my third year of medical school, I did several months of surgery, and although I enjoyed it, I thought, gosh, maybe this isn't for me. And I floated for a little while, but then I did a month of anesthesia, and it was amazingly fun for me. It was exciting, engaging. It isn't what you think.
Well, in what way? Explain that. I hear that from people in anesthesia all the time. But I'm not sure, why is it that way for you?
Well, there is no doctor-patient relationship more intimate or more engaging or more intense than the relationship between the anesthesiologist and you while you are asleep. We are responsible for all of your bodily functions. I mean, every physiologic function that God gave you, we can control and we can manipulate.
So you're breathing, going to the bathroom.
Going to the bathroom part. Yeah, actually, Foley catheters and so on to monitor urine output to make sure that your fluid status is fine. I participated in a surgery one time that lasted over 36 hours. It was unbelievable. So you can imagine in that particular extreme case that, yes, we were responsible for all those things. But in most cases, it's breathing, heart rate, brain function, of course, cognition, or that, you know, awake versus asleep, whether you're numb or not, do you feel things or not, even while you're asleep. And so those are the physiologic parameters that we're responsible for.
And so thinking about that doctor-patient relationship, mm-hmm. you know, the patient needs to trust or put some trust in the institution, in the surgeon in this anesthesiologist or the doctor that's putting them to sleep, when did they get to meet you and develop that sort of trust, or do they just have to go on faith?
Yeah, you bet, Chrissy. That's a really interesting question. In fact, when you asked me about my personal experiences, and so I'll share with you, I'm a little bit extroverted. I enjoy engaging. Yeah, well, it works well on a radio talk show. Yeah, sure. But people often ask me, why in the world did you go into anesthesia? Your patient contact is limited, and that just seemed odd to some individuals. But I flipped it on them. And relative to what you said, we have just a very few minutes to establish a doctor-patient relationship that builds on trust in a time of high stress. And that is, the patient is vulnerable. They may or may not have a significant disease. For example, let's say somebody's coming in for a biopsy for cancer. They are afraid, and they are uncertain about their future. And they're very concerned and worried. And on top of that, they're about ready to undergo general anesthesia and surgery. And so within a very short bit of time, maybe just even 2 to 5 minutes, the anesthesiologist has to provide information to the patient about what's going to happen. But also, probably just as importantly, the anesthesiologist needs to build trust and let that patient know that they are going to be well cared for and that everything's going to be okay. And I think that's a real trick and requires significant communication skills.
I can say you do it well. I will disclose, I wouldn't call it a conflict, but a family member needing to have a biopsy recently, that turned out fine, and this is where I met you. And your ability to be calming in the face of uncertainty, because you don't know the diagnosis beforehand, that trust was established in large part. I didn't know that you were the chairman at the time, and you came in and were very reassuring and calming while asking and delivering information.
Well, I can understand it from both sides. I, too, have had surgery, and perhaps relative to what we're talking about, my children have had surgery. And I'll tell you, there's nothing like a parent or a spouse bringing your loved one in and turning them over to a stranger, essentially, for potentially a risky procedure that is significant.
Speaking of risk, so you've got 2 to 5 minutes to talk with this patient, and presumably the surgeons talked with them before that day,
right,
if it's a choice. But what do you tell patients about safety, particularly about general anesthesia?
Well,
I guess we should start, what is general anesthesia compared with others, but
right.
Tell patients.
Right. Well, there are different types of anesthetics for sure. A local anesthetic is like what you get when you go to the dentist and they numb up your gum to fill a cavity. That's a classic local anesthetic. A regional anesthetic, in our jargon, is if you wanted to make the whole arm numb, for example, to do a procedure on somebody's forearm or hand so the whole arm goes numb, versus a general anesthetic where the whole body's numb. And so you could operate on the head or the toe, and they're equally numb, and the patient is not conscious under a general anesthetic. The risks, I tell folks that the risks can range from minor problems like a sore throat or a bruise from the IV. Those are the more common things, mm-hmm. all the way up to really bad things like stroke and death and just all those horrible things to think about. But really, the risk of general anesthesia, it's very small. In terms of putting it into context, I say it's like getting hit by lightning. It happens, and it happens to somebody every year, but the chances of it happening to you today under my care or under, in this procedure would be extremely, extremely small.
Has that changed? Because I suspect historically, like many things in medicine, there were many things and times in which we didn't have the science that made safety so obvious, particularly for surgery and anesthesia. What have been the 2 or 3 major breakthroughs in your career and even before that really have made a difference and really what, as you just described, is a fairly safe experience?
Wow. Adam, that's a really great question, and it really has changed, and it's changed over the course of these last 100 years, but it's accelerated over the course of the last 20 years, 20 to 30 years, which has essentially been my career. And The risks of general anesthesia have really been reduced. And
what happened?
Well, technology, for example. We have an ability through modern technology to monitor your physiologic condition. And then through alarms and systems, just like a modern airplane, we know prior to you getting into trouble that we're headed in the wrong direction. And so we can intervene to make it safer for you. Many years ago, 40 years ago or 50 years ago, those monitoring systems were not available, and now they're commonplace. As an indicator of that, you hear physicians frequently talk about their malpractice insurance, and it goes up and up and up. In anesthesiology, over the course of my career, our malpractice insurance has gone down. It's simply safer.
That is encouraging. We are going to need to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. David Zavara, about a patient guide to anesthesia and surgery. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. David Zavara, chair of the UNC Department of Anesthesiology, about a patient guide to anesthesia and surgery. And Dr. Zavara, you know, one of the things I think we hear, and you alluded to a little bit, were kind of the horror stories sometimes, but they don't happen very often. But it seems like when they do happen, they're all over the news. And we had the great horror story of, and it wasn't an anesthesiologist, but a cardiologist with Michael Jackson. And this propofol, but it seemed like all of a sudden, and I'm sure you were probably answering news requests, why is it that those horror stories still make the news when the safety is really the newsworthy item? Is it because it's not sexy to say that it's safe?
Well, that's a great question, and that's probably accurate, and it's similar to you don't hear news about how it's safe to travel and fly. Although in 2010, I guess it was a year without a single U.S. fatality in the airline industry. So similarly for us, there are 30 million surgeries per year. And it's rare to have a complication that is catastrophic that's solely related to anesthesiology.
What about with children? We haven't talked about, we talked about adults' anesthesia. What do we know about, because kids are still needing surgeries. Have there been advances in that field to also increase safety for children?
Oh, my gosh, yes. And, in fact, I'm so proud of what we're doing at UNC in our pediatric anesthesia specialties. Children are not small adults. Children are unique. They have special needs. For example, newborns. We do procedures in children that occur immediately at the time of birth.
It's really surgeries, and I mean some really intense surgeries.
Oh, absolutely. Well, we do these so-called exit procedures. I mean, it doesn't happen often, but a child might be born with a airway malformation and they're unable to breathe without help. And so from the first moment, in fact, before they're separated from their mother's placenta, the child is cared for by an anesthesiologist to secure the airway to allow survival. These are the things that our specialists do and are well trained for, and makes it unique. We do about 10,000 children per year at UNC pediatric hospitals, and it is safe.
Well, if you compare children going under surgery under general anesthesia and adults, is it safer for children, or is it more dangerous for children, or are there any differences?
Well, that's an interesting question because it isn't the same. In my specialty area, I practiced adult cardiac anesthesiology, and so I did anesthesia for people needing coronary bypass surgery. And so you have somebody who's maybe smoked or has high lipids and blood cholesterol and high blood pressure. That's not the same as as a 3 or 4 year old coming in for maybe a tumor or a hernia repair. The overall net safety, I mean, how many people are at very high risk might be about the same, but going down those different pathways is dramatically different.
You know, I was thinking about what seemed to me as an elective procedure on one of my children and thinking, well, if they had to have this and needed anesthesia, do I have the opportunity as a parent, not a physician, but as a parent, to talk to an anesthesiologist before I make the decision to have that surgery? And what do you offer patients in that way?
Well, absolutely, and it's something that we do provide. We provide counseling prior to surgery for people that request it. Oftentimes, in many of our surgical procedures, it isn't necessary to meet the anesthesiologist prior to the surgical procedure because there's no overriding health condition that's concerning. But we do have patients that it is beneficial to meet them before the surgery, either 1 to 2 days beforehand, to make sure that they're in the best medical condition that they can be in.
Or if they have a type A mom.
Or if they have a type A mom. Not that any of us are that way.
And a type B father. But
that's right.
Well, let me ask this question about, you know, if you were going to meet the anesthesiologist and you want to be prepared, and all of our listeners want to be prepared when they're going to meet, and they maybe haven't met an anesthesiologist much or at all.
That's right.
What are the questions that they should be prepared to come in to ensure that sense of trust and the answers? Are there some questions that you would recommend that patients really come in to talk about with the anesthesiologist?
Well, it's important to have a full medical history, just like with any physician interaction, and for us to understand what your medical problems are and what the issues can be. Just as an example, it occurs to me, we've had several patients now with our war situation, with post-traumatic stress disorders, mm-hmm. who have come in and have stated that under certain conditions, they become startled, and certainly undergoing anesthesia and surgery provides a stressful environment, and we've provided some psychological counseling for those individuals to allow them to move through surgery in a safer and friendlier fashion.
There are times in which you may have a choice between a regional or a general anesthetic, and certain things like that may influence that choice, patient's stress level or anxiety levels. Do you oftentimes try to give people choices, or how does that work?
Yes, we do try to give patient choices. And one of the things that we can do now that is new, more or less new in the last decade or so, is to provide long-acting anesthetics to patients to provide comfort after surgery. Hmm. We can do that by placing catheters in different nerve groups. And so, for example, if you have surgery on your wrist or ankle or your knee. My daughter had knee surgery for a torn ACL. A catheter was placed, which allowed my daughter, and I'll be very personal on this, to be pain-free for 48 to 72
which
hours.
One of the big things that people are scared about knee surgeries is the pain after surgery.
Well, that's exactly right. In fact, about 20 years or so ago, I did a little study that asked about patients' anxieties, and it was picked up in all the major journals, Glamour magazine, which was one of them, and it was about patient fears, and there are fears about three things basically. It's getting sick, it's feeling pain, and it's am I going to die. And the chances of death are so remotely small. They're present, but very small. Feeling sick after surgery, we've come a long way there, and we can provide medications to patients to reduce the chances of getting sick. And then pain. Our ability to manage pain is just so much better now than it was even just 5 years ago.
So you've talked some about the advances in your field related to technology, but what's sort of up and coming for new research in anesthesiology?
Well, gee, there's all sorts of different initiatives about the impact of the perioperative event on outcome. That is, are you going to do okay or not? In anesthesiology, we're interested in pain and pain mechanisms. At UNC right now, within our department, is some great research on the neurogenesis, or how pain begins. Why, for example, you or I may have the exact same surgical procedure, but you might have long going pain that might last for weeks or months, and I might recover in 1 or 2 days, or vice versa. Is that genetic? Is it something else? And our researchers are looking into that. Interestingly, they're looking at it in several populations, but one population is burn victims. Folks that have this burn injury, some recover extremely well, and some go on to have some discomfort that can last for a long time. And our pain specialists are really looking into that to see if they can help people over the long term.
It's such an important area to improve people's sort of sense of well-being and quality of life. So thank you for doing that research.
Yeah, it sounds like that you're the primary care doctor of the everything around anesthesia and surgical. I can see all these relationships and all these diseases in all types of patients. It's the extension of the work I think we do in the outpatient clinic, really throughout a whole nother realm of experience that's very scary for people. So thank you.
Well, that's exactly right. I like to say that we're the internist, or we're the doctor that's in the operating room. We have to understand what the patient's illness is, but not only that, we take these patients and then put them through stress. That is, we knock them out. We take them into a near coma-like state, so they're unconscious. Then the surgical procedure occurs, and sometimes that could be a really big deal, removal of tumors and potential blood loss and that type of thing. But then here's the real trick, is that we return the patient back to their normal state, ready to recover safely.
Remarkable.
Thank God you do that.
Yes.
That's right.
Literally.
We've been talking with UNC's Chair of Anesthesiology, Dr. David Zavara. Thank you so much for being with us and for all the work you do to keep our patients safe.
Well, thank you.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For House Call segment, we are going to answer your questions and concerns.
And if you have a question you'd like for us to address, we want you to send your comments or questions to yourhealth@unc.edu or call us at 966-8081.
And let's hear our very first house call from our listener today.
I've had a cough for almost 9 days now, and typically I don't go to the doctor because I know colds are common and they go away after a while. But at what point should I go see my family physician after I've had a cough for a long period of time?
That is such a good question, and especially at this time of the year where through this winter anyway, I feel like these viruses have been lasting a lot longer than usual. And it's hard to know when is the best time to go into the doctor.
Yeah, and I hear from patients all the time, you know, when they get to see me, they said, God, I wasn't certain whether I should come in or not. And, of course, after we finish the conversation, lots of times they go, I should have waited one more day. As if, you know, I could have told them in advance it was okay to wait one more day. But that is the crux of the matter here, Christy. Can you wait one more day?
Sure. And sometimes people after a virus will get this thing called a post-viral cough, where you just keep coughing after the virus. And, you know, time is the best thing that takes it away. I mean, I'd say if you're still coughing after a couple weeks, if you're getting worse, or you're getting
bringing up
new
green
fever
and yellow stuff that's not getting better,
mm-hmm,
you know, more than a week of green and yellow stuff that's not getting better could be a red flag.
Yeah, and certainly if you didn't have a fever before and now you're getting one, that would be a reason to come in as well. So
and
hope
if you bring up any
soon.
Blood when you're coughing, not a good thing.
Yeah, that'd
come,
be
come see
another
us.
Reason. Yeah, and if in doubt, it's worth a visit to the doctor just to have that conversation, even if it's just for reassurance.
Yeah, and there are some medicines we can give that can help suppress a cough sometimes. Sometimes coughing can actually prolong the, just like the post-viral cough that Christy talked about. So there are some things we can do, and hopefully thank you for your question, and we hope your cough's gone away. What's our very next house call?
So I have a friend who just gave birth for the first time a few weeks ago, and she's wanting to strictly breastfeed her son. She has a history of Raynaud's syndrome, and she's having problems with vasospasms in the nipple, and she wanted to know what she can do to relieve that.
This
is a really, really good question. And we at the Family Medicine Center take care of lots of women who are first-time breastfeeding, second-time breastfeeding, and put a lot of emphasis in that early breastfeeding to help, you know, promote and support you guys in this really good decision.
And we should say, first off, congratulations on choosing to breastfeed. That's a wonderful choice, and we're supportive of it, and we hope that most, if not all, women will choose to do this after the birth of their child, if they can.
And when you talk about vasospasms in the nipple related to Raynaud syndrome, there are a lot of people of childbearing age, up to 20%, I read, of women who have some who have Raynaud syndrome, which is where you get those spasms of your blood vessels, a lot of times in the fingers, but it can also happen in the nipples, and that could be painful and possibly misdiagnosed by the doctor.
Yeah, and you know, Chris, you have some more research on this, but I would imagine some of the things we do to try to prevent this in the fingers and the toes are some of the same things we might do for the nipples.
Yep.
Is that what the research shows?
Yeah. So really there are some case reports of this in the literature, and the treatment options are really, as you're saying, Adam, the same things you'd think of for people's fingers, trying to decrease exposure to cold. So trying to breastfeed in warm environments, to wear warm clothing to try to prevent the nipples from getting cold.
Could you put warm compresses on the nipple before breastfeeding? Would
mm-hmm.
that
potentially? Mm-hmm. To try to decrease caffeine. And then there's some other reported things like exercise and certain vitamins that might make a difference but aren't well proven. But I think one of the big things is making sure you communicate to your doctor that you've had this Raynaud's symptoms of your fingers, which makes it more likely to happen in your nipples, so they're not thinking it's a yeast infection or thinking it's mastitis or something else.
Do we know, Christy, if pumping of the breast would have the same impact on this experience of the Raynaud's of the nipple for a woman who has this as compared to, let's say, breastfeeding? Would pumping be an alternative?
We don't know. I would think that your breast would be more likely to be warm if you had a baby up against mm-hmm. you. And a lot of mm-hmm. the benefits of breastfeeding really support to try to do it directly when possible. But if it is better with pumping, then that's a really good and important thing to do, too. I think you have to see what works.
Yep. So please let us know what is working for you, and we hope that it's going well, and we know that it's not an easy thing. So thank you for sharing that question with us. What is our very next house call?
Hi. Well, I have a question about my mom, who is in her late 80s, and she got diagnosed with atrial fibrillation a couple years ago, and the doctor talked to her about taking Coumadin, but we didn't think it was a great idea because then she'd have to go back to the clinic a lot and get her blood checked. And sometimes she falls, and that seemed kind of scary because she might bleed. So the question is whether that's the right thing to do, to not have her on Coumadin. She's been taking like a regular strength aspirin, you know, and she hasn't had any complications so far. So that's my question. Is this an okay thing to do?
Ooh, good question.
A great question. And one, I think as family physicians, we struggle with this decision a lot, to help families really understand the benefits and the risk of taking a blood thinner Coumadin when you have atrial fibrillation.
You know, Christy, I was just involved with an admission to the hospital of someone just last week who's actually in their 90s and has this atrial fibrillation and had decided for a long time, not to take a blood thinner called Coumadin because of the chance of a fall, and they're worried about that. And yet here they're still in their 90s, and we still had to have that same conversation again when they came in the hospital.
Sure, because when you have atrial fibrillation, you're at a higher risk of having a stroke, and that can be devastating. And we know being on the blood thinner decreases your risk for a stroke. But if you're falling down a lot or having trouble with balance, then being on a blood thinner puts you at risk for a dangerous bleed in your head or otherwise in your body. So it's definitely a calculation of risks and benefits that you have to have together with your whole family and a doctor as well.
But also realize that aspirin alone does give benefit.
It does.
And it will reduce the risk. And the absolute benefit of the Coumadin is there, But again, you get the benefit with the aspirin. So for a lot of our patients, depending on your medical conditions, either one could be acceptable choice that you make when you're talking with your physician.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's do our very last house call of the day.
Yeah, I was wondering, my baby had that croupy cough last night and couldn't remember whether he was supposed to be in a hot steam bath or a cool mist bath. So we did both, but I was wondering which one is the right one.
A creepy cough. Well, that sounds bad, and it certainly sounds a little bit like this time of year, what we would call croup.
Yes, croup. I can tell you from personal experience, it's so scary.
You've had croup?
No, I can tell you from being a parent of a child with croup that it is scary when your child is really having that barky cough and struggling to breathe in that way.
Christy, I'm going to have to disclose something to our listeners and to you. I had croup really bad as a child, and I had to go to the emergency room multiple times. And my mother, I think I even know the answer to this based upon what my mother used to take me outdoors and thrust me and make me kind of stand outdoors and holding me when I had a bad croup, because she said that was one of the few things that could sometimes prevent her from taking me to the emergency room.
Sure. Well, we're glad that she did.
I made it.
And you made it, yeah. But it's scary as a parent. And if it's mild, then you can do home remedies like, you know, you want to reduce the fever and give your child fluids if they can drink it safely. A lot of people will do humidifier to kind of moisten the air. And warm steam, like putting a child in the bathroom with the shower running just to sort of have it warm, and cold air are both recommended. It's actually not very well studied to prove that cold air is better.
Not so scientific, you mean?
Not so scientific to say that cold air is better, but the thinking right now is that doing opening a freezer and letting the child breathe in that cold air, or taking them on a drive in the car with the windows down to let the cold air come in, is helpful to kind of calm it down, calm that inflammation down. I guess kind of like if you put ice on a swollen joint, the cold air can sort of help open up those airways a little bit.
And sometimes just knowing the natural history of croup, that it starts out mild and it will get worse and worse, and it will reach its peak a period of time, usually, you know, 1 to 3 days after the cough starts, and then gets better. And so a lot of times when we get calls are sometimes when it is at its worst, but hopefully most times it gets better fairly quickly.
And if there's any question, you always want to take the child in, because steroids can be helpful as well as some other inhaled medicines.
Well, thank you so much for your house calls today. We've had a nice chance to really talk a little bit about croup and maybe what we can do. And
about AFib.
Atrial fibrillation and Coumadin versus aspirin. And
about
this Raynaud's phenomena and vasospasm of the nipple.
Mm-hmm. About an ongoing cough.
Yep. Well, that's going to conclude Your Health Today. We thank you for all of your questions, all of your concerns. Send us them to your own questions at yourhealthradio.org. Send us to twitter.com and search for Your Health Radio.
We'd like to thank the staff of WCHL, UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, and our guest today, Dr. David Zavara. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And we'll talk to you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website, 1360WCHL.com, and click on WCHL On Demand. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360 WCHL.